Absolute ton to talk about this week, as we were knocked onto the disabled list just a little bit last week, so we were not in studio. So we have a 2-week super show here for you of a lot of information for us to get through. And so we're going to get right into it, talking about this week in the NFL. This week in NFL news, the NFL Players Association has announced a grievance has been filed against the league. They are alleging that the 32 teams and the NFL itself violated the requirements of the collective bargaining agreement on giving out prescription painkillers to players, saying, quote, according to the NFLPA, the league did not, to the best of its ability, ensure compliance with all federal, state, local requirements, including all ethical rules and professional standards, close quote. And we've already started getting discovery in the lawsuit against the league that's been filed by a number of players. And throughout the discovery phase of this lawsuit, we've seen some very damning and very disconcerting information coming out. A memo from the Atlanta Falcons that talked about a phone call between their current vice president of finance, Rob Jeffroy, the director of sports medicine and performance, Marty Lawson, assistant director Danny Long, and NFL's director of benefits, Marianne Fleming. And in this memo, they talked about how the Atlanta Falcons team medical log for all the medication that's been distributed to members of the teams had no doctor's signatures on it, and it was really unclear as to what was given to the players. There was also a lack of clarity on communication between the trainers and the doctors, and that, quote, there is no evidence that the doctor actually knows what medication has been given to the players, close quote. We also have a 2008 email from January 7th of 2008 from the then head trainer Eric Sugarman of the Minnesota Vikings that states that the number of Ambien, Toradol, and other shots that were recorded as given out didn't match the number of shots that were missing from the kits. That there are a number of shots, quote, that have not been accounted for at all, close quote. We also have testimony from a Buffalo Bills doctor, Dr. John Marzo, that he would travel with controlled substances to give to players as late as 2014, even though in 2011, he was told that he was not allowed to do that. He also testified that the team's doctors and trainers did not caution players about mixing medications. We also saw testimony from Bills trainer Bud Carpenter at his deposition that he witnessed team doctors injecting players with prescription medication without even telling them what the drug was or the side effects of it. In a August 24, 2009 email, Cincinnati Bengals head trainer Paul Sparling asked for a copy of a DEA certificate to be faxed to him, saying, quote, I need it for my records when the NFL pill counters come to see if we're doing things right. Don't worry, I'm pretty good at keeping them off the trail, close quote. There's also more correspondence between the Detroit Lions head trainer and the Cincinnati Bengals head trainer, saying, quote, we will continue to do as we have done for the past 42 years. I would love to know who blew up the system that worked all of these years, close quote, largely talking about the ability for them to take controlled substances across state lines and distribute those, even though they didn't have medical licenses in the states that they were in. And we have talked about this quite often on this show, of how the painkiller issue is a much, much more dangerous issue than the cannabis issue that the NFL really seems ardent in pushing to fight and continuing to fight and continuing to fight. We also have an October 13th, 2014 survey that was responded to by 27 of the 32 NFL teams that noted that 26.7 players per game took at least one shot of the painkiller Toradol. Toradol, which has also been connected to brain bleeds and other dangerous side effects, to simply just get them back out on the field and playing, that a number of players per game took at least one shot of this painkiller medication. We also have a memo from March 1st, 2013 from Lawrence Brown of the NFL to the Steelers team doctor, Dr. Anthony Yates, that says, quote, there was documentation of dispensing by a non-physician. Please reevaluate to ensure that this behavior is congruent with federal and state regulations, close quote. The letter also noted that in 2012, the Steelers gave out 7,442 doses of painkillers compared to the NFL average of 5,777 doses per team. We also have testimony from the Steelers doctor that as of 2010, a majority of teams, quote, had trainers controlling and handling prescription medications and controlled substances when they should not have, close quote. He also talked about players, quote, lining up for the T train, close quote, that was Toradol painkiller injections, something that had been occurring with the team, according to Dr. Yates, for at least the last 15 years. A few weeks ago on the broadcast, we talked about a drug enforcement agency agent having conversations with a number of team doctors, with team doctors booing him for saying things like the fact that they had to follow federal law, also saying that soldiers being able to be given the special dispensation to avoid some of these laws because of the realities of that situation. One of the team doctors said, well, I see my players as warriors, so why don't we get the same thing too? Or the Dallas Cowboys team doctor arguing that he was going to try to get the representative changed by pouring a bunch of money into the campaign, and then we saw subsequent mass donations from the Dallas Cowboys ownership structure and their families to the opposition candidate in that race. Now, the NFL Players Association, citing some of these documents, citing some of the issues that have been brought up in the lawsuit, want to know what the team knew and who knew it. They want the information that is going to show whether or not these teams in the NFL were following the prescriptions of the collective bargaining agreement. They want to fire any medical staff who violated the collective bargaining agreement. They want a new discipline policy in place, and that the union's medical director get all the health and safety committee information and copies of painkiller records and medical training done by team staff. And so this grievance is, of course, in the very early stages. It will very likely be litigated out for some time, but we will certainly be keeping an eye on it as it goes on and on. As well as the aforementioned lawsuit against the league and a number of teams, much of that lawsuit was ultimately dismissed in court this week, with the judge arguing that there is limited evidence that the players' health problems are due to their treatment from team doctors, that it became difficult for them to isolate and say that their health problems were only because of the team doctors lining them up and giving them Toradol shots and other painkillers, that some of their health maladies could have come from other issues at hand. And so much of the lawsuit there has been dismissed. We're also seeing labor acrimony between the players of the NFL and the league as teams are trying to put language in new contracts that would take away guaranteed money from players if they are suspended or even if they face a team fine. So if you show up 5 to 10 minutes late for a team meeting, that could not only cost you the fine, it could also cost you millions of dollars of guaranteed money. So they're trying to put this kind of language in place. It's another pushback by management, hoping to get mass concessions from the players for this kind of overstep, this kind of overreach, the really ridiculous move by these billionaires who want to try to keep the players making as little as possible with nothing being their optimum. The NFL Players Association, given some of this labor acrimony that we're already starting to see, and it's likely only to intensify as we get closer and closer to the collective bargaining agreement coming due, the NFL Players Association has announced a reserves program to be set up for any potential work stoppage that happens with the 2021 season. They're putting licensed royalties into this fund that could get up to $90 million, plus the normal amount of money being set aside for the work stoppage fund. And we could certainly see a work stoppage. We saw one with the last collective bargaining agreement because the NFL wanted mass concessions and thought they could get them, so they locked the players out to try to get some of those mass concessions. We're seeing it with Roger Goodell's push and use of his authority in the hopes that they'll walk that back a little bit in exchange for getting concessions from the players. Or the issue about medical cannabis, that they're going to try to get mass concessions from the players in exchange for easing up on a policy that is logical, it's reasonable, it makes a whole lot of sense. And even a whole lot of NFL owners want to change to that policy, but they're not going to advocate for it publicly unless they're willing to get some kind of mass concessions from the players. So with the labor acrimony, the labor relationship between the teams and the players not going very well in the NFL. Speaking of labor acrimony, the cheerleaders of the NFL are having some very serious issues with management, as the Oakland Raiders are now the latest team to get a settlement. They are going to get $1.25 million in exchange for a settlement over allegations that the cheerleaders were required to work for minimum wage. About 90 members of the team will get between $2,500 and $6,000 each. They said that they were paid $125 per game by the Raiders, with one check at the end of the season. They had to show up for personal appearances. They had to show up for practices that were all unpaid labor. They were also not reimbursed for anything they had to personally buy. And fines were taken out of their end of season pay. And that when you logged it all together, it was less than minimum wage. We've seen similar wage theft lawsuits filed by the cheerleaders of the Cincinnati Bengals, the Buffalo Bills, the New York Jets, and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Raiders have now settled for $1.25 million. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers cheerleaders got $800,000. The Bengals had to pay out $255,000. We're seeing huge cash settlements happening over wage theft. And wage theft is something that's happening inside the sports world. It's happening outside the sports world. And it's when workers come together and they take action, whether that's through wildcat strikes, whether workers take action through labor militancy and slowdowns. But fighting workplace injustice brings the goods. Fighting workplace injustice is the right thing to do. And of course, there's kind of the little flippant quip of fight workplace injustice and apparently win fabulous cash prizes while doing so. That wage theft is a real thing inside the sports world, outside the sports world, and workers coming together and advocating for each other and taking direct action for each other is a very powerful, powerful technique, whether that's done through the legal sphere and taking it to the courts and the National Labor Relations Board, or taking more direct action in workplace actions. Last week on the show, we also talked about the issue of domestic violence. In trigger warning, we are going to be talking about issues of domestic violence in this story, quite obviously. The Seattle Seahawks player Frank Clark let some mass stupid fall out of his head. We had talked with University of Illinois Women's Resources Center and advocate Molly McClay over the NFL's decision to have 1 hour of training on domestic violence with the players. 1 hour on one day, and how that was woefully, terribly inadequate. Well, Frank Clark, who is now a member of the Seattle Seahawks, was kicked off the University of Michigan football team over allegations of domestic violence. The charges were dropped when he ended up pleading out to disorderly conduct. He was drafted by the Seahawks, who really didn't do much of any kind of investigation into him. They really didn't look at any of the instances. They didn't interview any of the survivors. They didn't interview the police. They didn't go and get any kind of records to do any real investigation into this, but drafted him anyway. Well, journalist and writer Natalie Wiener was writing about a domestic violence incident and then linked back to her past article that she wrote about Frank Clark in her Twitter stream. She had simply just linked to the past article that she had written about Frank Clark's history of domestic violence when she was talking about a more recent one. Well, Frank Clark responded with a tweet that he very quickly deleted afterwards, saying, quote, "People like you don't have long careers in your field. I have a job for you cleaning my fish tank when that little job is over." One hour on one day of domestic violence training, NFL. It's clearly not enough. Frank Clark then tweeted out a non-apology apology, saying, quote, "Apologize to anyone who felt offended by my tweet earlier. We gotta do better supporting these major issues we face in this world," close quote. It's not that you're apologizing to people who felt offended. That's a non-apology apology. That is not an apology. That's not an apology at all. Afterwards, he tweeted and geotagged himself at Seahawks headquarters, where they said that they had expressed their, quote, "extreme disappointment," close quote, with Frank Clark. And in the subsequent tweets from Frank Clark, he said, quote, "I understand the seriousness of this subject. I want to apologize to Natalie Wiener for letting my emotions get the best of me about comments made towards my personal life and family. I have worked hard over the last 2 years to do right, not only for myself, but for my family as well. I will continue on this path on and off the field," close quote. And certainly that statement comes about, this is the second apology, the second attempt, and geotagging himself at the Seahawks headquarters, where it was pretty much abundantly clear that the team put the pressure on him to say something about this and do it in a very serious and meaningful way, because not only was Frank Clark getting raked over the coals of public outrage, but so were the Seattle Seahawks. And his argument that he understands the seriousness of this subject and wants to apologize is belied and undercut and dismantled by the fact that he was liking tweets throughout his account up until that point, saying that he shouldn't have to apologize, that he didn't need to apologize, that she was in the wrong for writing this article. And it really continues to show why the league needs to spend more than 1 hour on one day talking about these issues. That if they're really going to say no more and mean no more, then they need to talk about it for more than 1 hour on one day. It needs to be more substantive. It needs to be interlaced. It needs to be brought in and delved into deeply and start dismantling some of these structures of toxic masculinity with the players. It needs to happen that way. It must occur for there to be some very real benefits to happen. 1 hour on one day is really more of a PR stunt. Let's seriously mean no more if you're going to say no more, and do it the right way. Well, we're also going to jump into NBA news as we are in the midst of the NBA playoffs. Everyone's pretty much waiting for the Cavaliers versus the Warriors to happen in the finals. So hopefully we can get there very, very quickly. But until then, we've got some news to talk about here with the Intersections of Politics. The former Atlanta Hawk, Mike Scott, is back in the news again. Mike Scott was arrested in 2015 when he was pulled over by a deputy of the Banks County, Georgia Sheriff's Office. Officer Brent Register pulled him over and then searched his car. Officer Register eventually found 10.9 grams of MDMA and 1.2 ounces of marijuana. Well, a judge looked at the search, looked at the arrest, and said that the entire case was being tossed because the stop was racially motivated and that Officer Register was fired from the Banks County Sheriff's Office. The judge noticed that registered testimony during the trial, quote, was in contradiction to admitted documentary evidence, close quote, and that in the 2015-2016 year, Officer Register stopped over 1,400 cars with 8 citations and 47 arrests. 44 of those 47 arrests were non-white people. And that's largely the issue here. You stop 1,400 cars and you have 8 citations. You stopped 1,400 cars and you gave out 8 citations. Banks County Sheriff's Office released a statement after Officer Register was pretty much raked over the coals, the stop being thrown out, the case against Mike Scott being thrown out for being racially motivated. And the sheriff's office saying, quote, "We addressed an issue that was brought to our attention immediately. In the profession of law enforcement, issues will arise in every agency due to an essence of individuals being imperfect. One officer's action does not reflect on the agency as a whole," close quote. No, what reflects on the agency as a whole is the fact that somehow you guys didn't notice this. You guys get the data. You guys see who he's arresting. You guys see that information, and you either A, didn't notice it, which shows a little bit of incompetency, or B, noticed it and didn't say anything until the judge made it public and embarrassed you guys. So it's either incompetency or knowing that it was there and not doing anything about it, either of which is not a good look. You addressed an issue that was brought to your attention immediately. It shouldn't need to have been brought to your attention. You should have been able to see this and have oversight of this before it got to such an extent. And the notice of not seeing a thing until the judge said something shows either incompetency or a lack of willingness to really meaningfully deal with it until a judge said something. And who knows how many more of these cases are out there? Who knows how many more of these kinds of cases happen? But they don't have the money, they don't have the finances, they don't have the ability to take it to court and push and have really high quality lawyers push back against it like Mike Scott's able to do because of his time in the NBA. That how many more of these cases, more of these structures are there? And we don't hear about them because the people do not have the finances, they do not have the notoriety, they do not have the public cachet to cash in on to get that information out publicly the same way that a former member of the NBA would be able to get out after he successfully fought against an arrest. Well, the Spurs coach, Greg Popovich, was in the news talking about the president asking at a press conference if he was ever distracted by events outside of sports. Popovich said, quote, "It's interesting you would ask that. Usually things happen in the world and you go to work, you know, and you've got your family and you've got your friends and you do what you do. But to this day, I feel like there's a cloud, a pall over the whole country in a paranoid, surreal sort of way. It's got nothing to do with the Democrats losing the election. It's got to do with the way one individual conducts himself. And that's embarrassing. It's dangerous to our institutions and all that we stand for, what we expect the country to be. But for this individual, he's in a game show. And everything that happens begins and ends with him, not our people or our country. Every time he talks about those things, it's just a ruse. That's just disingenuous, cynical, and fake." Steve Kerr of the Golden State Warriors was asked if a NBA coach could succeed with a Trump-style approach to coaching players. And he responded saying, quote, "I think it probably could have worked 20 or 30 years ago. Think about Bobby Knight. My personal opinion is Bobby Knight's way smarter than Donald Trump. Bobby Knight was brilliant in a lot of ways, so there was some real foundation in terms of knowing and coaching the game. But he was a bully, so I don't think being a bully doesn't work today, or at least it doesn't work in coaching. The modern coach has to be much more communicative, flexible, aware, conscientious, all those things. Frankly, I think it's why Trump couldn't be more ill-suited to be president, because he's a blowhard. You don't see some of the qualities you talk about, the resilience, the ability to communicate, the compassion. None of that. But in the old days, a lot of great coaches who maybe didn't have those, there was still a fiber there, whatever it was. To be a great leader there, you have to have some of those qualities there. Has anyone ever thought that Donald Trump was a great leader? Close quote. And of course, this is not the first time that either of these guys have spoken out about President Trump and the current state of affairs and the current state of politics, and using the platforms that they've got to raise this kind of awareness, to build the bridges of people who might not necessarily get involved in politics or be politically minded. Being able to hear this coming into the sports world shows a interconnectivity between sports and politics to reach people who wouldn't necessarily otherwise engage with the subject matter or engage with it in such a way that Popovich, Kerr, and others are bringing in their involvement with this. Something we here are trying to do as well, trying to bridge some of those connections, people who might not engage with politics, but being able to do through the vector of sports, and also showing that a lot of politically minded folks, there are connections to sports, that we can't necessarily write off sports to the political right, that we can't cede this space just to the most reactionary of the reactionary political right. You're listening to Not Another Sports Show, a Radical Look at the World Sports Left Sports Media. We've just been discussing the NFL potentially facing issues in their impending labor battles. Seattle Seahawks' Frank Clark shows how the NFL needs to do a whole lot more in actually handling domestic violence seriously. NBA coaches speak out about the president. And another former sports star highlights the problems with policing. Coming up on Not Another Sports Show, a Radical Look at the World of Sports, we'll be analyzing the slow movement to get rid of racist iconography in Cleveland. The Atlanta baseball stadium finds yet another way to be the worst stadium deal ever. And we'll also be talking the latest in unpaid college sports news. So we're going to jump straight over to some baseball news. In baseball news this week, the owner of the Cleveland Major League Baseball team, he is continuing negotiations with Major League Baseball over getting rid of their racist logo chief, Wahoo. And this is a logo that is totally bigoted. It needs to have gotten rid of yesterday, but the fact that it's 2017 and it's still there is a blight. In recent comments about the decision, owner Paul Dolan said, quote, "Some want to keep Wahoo, some want to get rid of him, but the issue is not going to go. We are mindful that there are people who are offended by it, and frankly, if you leave Northeastern Ohio, it changes the perspective on these changes. We were on some path towards a middle ground. I don't know what that path was, and that's still where we're headed, but where we're headed there faster than we ever liked because the commissioner of baseball weighed in on this." Close quote. I read this statement a number of times in prep for the show, and I'm still not totally sure what he's actually saying here. We are mindful that there are people who are offended by it, and frankly, if you leave Northeastern Ohio, it changes. Yeah, people outside of Northeastern Ohio all think this is racist, bigoted garbage and needs to be thrown into the dustbin of history. And the fact that it's 2017 and this thing is still adorning a Major League Baseball franchise, a multi-billion dollar corporation, is more than just a bit problematic. We were on some path towards a middle ground. I don't know what that path was. So you're on a path that you didn't know what it was? And you're heading on a path that you don't know what it was faster because Major League Baseball's commissioner weighed in on the issue. Really, what this is all about, it seems to be, is you want to keep a logo that's racist and bigoted and dumb and really stupid, and it needs to be gotten rid of and thrown away very fast. And you want to move slowly. Why would you want to move slowly? Is it selling merchandise? Is it fear of reactionary fans pushing back, of political correctness, which is really just treating people with respect? what could potentially be the rationale? Moving slowly enough to get white people comfortable with this move. Because honestly, that's a lot of the moves that happen only happen when you get very middle of the road, center right white people comfortable with it is when the moves start to occur. And a middle ground, you want to find some kind of middle ground with this racist logo? Do you want a kinder, warmer, fuzzier version of institutional racism? There is no middle ground. Wahoo needs to have been gotten rid of, and it needs to have been gotten rid of already. And the arguments in favor of it fall apart totally. Meanwhile, the Atlanta Major League Baseball stadium deal in Cobb County is quite possibly one of the worst. It's one of the biggest boondoggles in professional sports. It's been a horrendous, just terrible bath for the taxpayers. They got the lie about there being no new taxes to fund the stadium while they were taking a set of taxes that were meant to sunset and then extended them past the sunset provision, which, of course, by definition, makes it a new tax. They talked about money being meant for public parks and then took that money for public parks and spent it on the stadium. They violated the open meetings laws by having rotating groups of the member of the Cobb County Board of Commissions go listen to the team's pitch while the rest of them stood out in the hallway. They stacked the public comment with stadium supporters and then capped the amount of public comment to only let the stadium supporters speak. They've had to have residents pay more in taxes now to get the parks that they originally approved funding, because the money that was originally meant to go to those parks was diverted to give these billionaires a brand new baseball stadium. Well, now, the newest thing to add on to this poop heap is that the police who will be working the traffic at the home games won't be paid by the Atlanta baseball team. They'll be paid by the taxpayers to the tune of $900,000 per year. Yes, that's right. The team will not be paying for the police to do the security work. It's going to come out of the taxpayers' budget. And since there was not a specific line item in the Cobb County budget for this, much the same way there wasn't a specific set of line items for a lot of the transportation issues related to this stadium, $900,000 per year plus will be coming out of the Cobb County General Fund. Funny, I could think of a lot better things to spend that money on. Social services, schools, helping the community. But no, why have that when we can help further enrich billionaires by giving them the subsidized cost of yet another thing at this stadium boondoggle? Meanwhile, outfielder of the Baltimore Orioles Adam Jones is back in the news talking about the racist abuse that he faced in Boston and athletes speaking out in general on political issues, saying, quote, "As athletes, we do have to be censored in a certain way. But at the same time, if there's a big issue and it's something you stand for, you've got to speak out. Because if you're worried about the backlash, I think silence is just as bad. I'm not afraid of the backlash because it's the truth. It's my truth through my eyes. We all have our own truths. How we were raised, that's our truth. Growing up in San Diego, or California in general, it's a very liberal state. I grew up with blacks, whites, Mexicans, Filipinos. Everything was diverse. My class wasn't predominantly anything. Playing sports, it was diverse. My neighborhood was diverse. The worst thing is when people say, I don't see color. I think that's the dumbest thing. Unless you are colorblind, you see color. You may choose not to think of the other things that come up with color, but you see color. At the ballpark in San Diego, you see that diversity. LA, Arizona, San Francisco, both Texas teams, you just see so much diversity. Growing up like that, I always assumed the rest of the United States, the rest of the world was like that," close quote. And that's largely one of these things about colorblindness and this being a colorblind age. No, we all see race. We all see color. We just don't like when it's brought up or the legacies of institutional racism being brought up and pushed forward. That we're not all on an even playing field. We're not all on an even ground to run the race of equals. And when Curt Schilling, the former pitcher, former ESPN talking head personality, said that Adam Jones was making up the racist abuse in Boston, Adam Jones said, quote, "Schilling is over there with his rants. He just wants an outlet. Somebody will take his call, take his rants. He can keep them for himself because he's never experienced anything like I have. I'll stick with what Mark McLemore said about it. Schilling, hell of a career, but he's never been black and he's never played the outfield in Boston," close quote. And that's so succinctly such a easy takedown of Curt Schilling and his pushback there. Hell of a career, but he's never been black, and he's never played the outfield in Boston. Meanwhile, the Toronto Blue Jays have suspended center fielder Kevin Pillar for 2 games for an anti-gay slur towards a pitcher. Pillar came out and said that his statement was, quote, immature and, quote, stupid. He also issued a statement, and Mark Clark, take note, this is what an apology should sound like. Quote, "I used inappropriate language towards Braves pitcher Jason Mott. By doing so, I had just helped extend the use of a word that has no place in baseball, in sports, or anywhere in society today. I am completely and utterly embarrassed and feel horrible to have put the fans, my teammates, and the Blue Jays organization in this position. I've apologized personally to Jason Mott, but also need to apologize to the Braves organization and their fans, and most importantly to the LGBTQ community for the lack of respect I displayed that night. This is not who I am, and I will use this as an opportunity to better myself," close quote. That is an apology. And as we've seen with other players who have used anti-gay slurs, that they've been involved with actual charity events, they've been involved with things like the Trevor Project or the It Gets Better Project, to put a little bit of their proverbial money where their mouth is. That there needs to be a punishment, which we've seen here, but there also needs to be that educational component that goes with it. There needs to be the educational component that goes with it. And I think Pillar having that opportunity would, again, show that he could have this opportunity to better himself. And what's really interesting to me is when these stories came out, there was a lot more vigorous debate about Jose Bautista being down 8-3, hitting a home run, and flipping his bat about being disrespectful to the game than there was about Pillar's statement towards this pitcher. That there was more of a discussion, more media time, more airtime, more ink spilled on whether or not Jose Bautista's act of flipping a bat was incredibly disrespectful to the game of baseball than there was of an anti-gay slur being uttered by a player on the field during a game. That should say something that's kind of disconcerting about the state of sports media and why we can't just continue to cede these spaces to the political right. Meanwhile, in unpaid college sports news, the state of North Carolina is back in the news with a new petition calling on the Pac-12 conference to live up to its, quote, commitment to gender equity, close quote, by suspending travel to that state over the not repeal repeal of House Bill 2, the anti-trans, anti-gay, anti-worker bill that had been passed and ultimately saw the NCAA remove championship events for a time period from that state. Over 16,000 people have currently signed that Pac-12 petition to get them to suspend travel to the state for that conference. Meanwhile, the NAACP has been pressuring the NCAA over moving its softball tournament from the state of Mississippi because the Mississippi state flag still has the Confederate battle emblem in their state flag. The University of Mississippi in Oxford is hosting a event based on their team doing very well in softball this season. The NCAA spokeswoman, Gail Dent, said, quote, "Championships where student-athletes earn the opportunity to play a championship on their own campus are not covered in the Confederate flag policy. This distinction is consistent with the NCAA's commitment to student-athletes," close quote. I see. Being opposed to the Confederate flag as a ridiculous problem is one thing that they're for, but suddenly it's okay if the team is in the same state and they win the right to host themselves holding it, which makes me think, firstly, LOL, what? And secondly, if the Confederate flag is a problem, then it remains a problem for the entirety of the time, rather than these weasel words to try to avoid making an issue. And if they really want to have a truly accurate Confederate flag, if they really want the most accurate Confederate flag, just put a white cloth on a flagpole, and you have the most important and most accurate Confederate flag, the one that they waved when they gave up. Meanwhile, the University of Southern Florida is back in the news, and trigger warning, we are going to be talking about issues of sexual assault. In their previous broadcast, we talked about then-football player Ladarius Jackson being suspended from the team over charges of sexual battery and false imprisonment. Well, he has now been removed from the team after a second arrest alleging the exact same thing. And the University of Baylor is back in the news. The Baylor tire fire continues to burn and continues to get worse and worse and worse, with another Title IX lawsuit being filed against the school, this time by a former volleyball player. And trigger warning, we are going to be talking about issues of sexual assault in this story as well. This former volleyball player alleges that she was sexually assaulted by at least 4 and as many as 8 different football players, and she claims that there is, quote, at least one video, close quote, of sexual assault that happened, and it alleges that this was a, quote, bonding experience by the players, close quote, and part of a team hazing process, close quote. This is all the reasons why we need to dismantle toxic masculinity, these kinds of toxic ideas of what it means to be a man. That these are really dangerous, they're deleterious, they're problematic, they're really horrendous, they stunt male emotional growth and the scope of male emotion. And it's really problematic not only for men, but the impacts of it on other people, not only themselves, get to be the very real and disturbing issue, as we're seeing here with this yet another Title IX lawsuit that's been filed against Baylor University. And we'll, of course, be keeping an eye on this one as it goes through, just to see how things turn out. You've been listening to Not Another Sports Show, a radical look at the world of sports, left sports media. We've just been discussing the Atlanta Stadium boondoggle for Major League Baseball, finding a new way to get worse, more allegations against Baylor, and the owner of the Cleveland Major League Baseball team just happens to lament that he may need to get rid of his racist iconography that adorns his franchise faster than he would have liked. Coming up on Not Another Sports Show, a radical look at the world of sports, we'll be analyzing updates in the lack of accountability for the officers that attacked tennis star James Blake, updates on the FIFA Congress and what happened there, and some positive news to close out our broadcast. And so we are going to move into our final segments of the show, This Week in Other Sports News. Longtime listeners of this show, or longtime sports fans or political junkies, may remember the 2015 story of former tennis star James Blake being tackled and arrested by New York City police officers. Blake had done nothing wrong except be standing in a sidewalk in New York. He was slammed to the ground, he was handcuffed, he was detained by police in a case of mistaken identity. He had suffered a number of bruises and cuts when he got thrown to the ground and handcuffed by Officer James Frascatore. And Officer Frascatore faced excessive force charges for this case. The video came out showing the arrest, and they very quickly realized that they had messed up. In fact, as we saw, a cover-up started very quickly after, where they tried not to even log the stop in the police log after they realized that they screwed up. But the video of Officer Frascatore and his partner throwing James Blake to the ground, pinning him down, and arresting him put a stop to the attempt to try to not even log their stop in this police log. The pictures came out online of the man that they were supposedly looking for that was supposedly Blake's quote-unquote twin. That guy was innocent too. Yeah, the guy that they were looking for was also innocent. And the most ironic part of all of this to me is that they were investigating the crime of identity fraud, where people could be put out and, you know, shown to have done things that they didn't actually do. But apparently that doesn't apply to throwing a guy's image up online and saying that he did all of these terrible things and is accused of being a criminal. No, apparently that's okay. Or putting, you know, James Blake into the street and throwing him down on the sidewalk to arrest him when he did nothing wrong. Of course, the police union came out, and I use union in quotes there to talk about the police union, said that Officer James Frascatore did nothing wrong, he didn't do anything bad, he didn't do anything that was not acceptable. But Officer Frascatore had a history and has a history of racial profiling complaints against him, with at least 6 racial profiling complaints against him, and at least 4 excessive force complaints against him. Most of those focused on being detained with no explanation. Most of those people argued that they were mistreated after they had complied. The union said that he was exonerated on 1, another was unsubstantiated, and in a 3rd one, he was sanctioned for not identifying himself to the public. Well, Democracy Now! In 2015 had an interview with survivors of Frascatore's violence, and the audio had a family talking about one of their loved ones being thrown into the street, beaten and maced, for the crime of riding a bike on a sidewalk. He was beaten and maced for riding a bike on a sidewalk. His wife was arrested too because she wouldn't immediately get the bike out of the house. And they were caught on audio. Frascatore and his partner were caught on audio saying the most horrendous and atrocious things, caught on audio saying it to these people. And ultimately, all the charges were dropped in these cases. They discussed another case where they had arrested a guy and charged him with assault on a police officer because Frascatore cut his hand, where he claimed that the suspect bit him. However, medical evidence from the medical examiner and Frascatore himself admitted that he punched the guy in the mouth and his hand was cut on a tooth in throwing that punch at the man's face. He was not bitten. You punched him in the face and you admitted that, and then are going to charge him with assaulting you when you punched him in the head. These kinds of cases are utterly indefensible. The case with James Blake is utterly indefensible, which makes me wonder, how many times does an officer like James Frascatore or other police officers who are involved in shootings, what do they have to do to be held accountable? What do they have to do to be held accountable for something? You know, just this week we saw the Tulsa case of a man who was shot by a Tulsa police officer, and one of the jurors saying that he thought that, you know, he voted for not guilty because he was tired and hungry, and that was the reason of the not guilty verdict. What do these officers have to do to be held accountable? Well, the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York was set to have a public trial this week for James Frascatore. But There is no public hearing being held. It has been postponed indefinitely, and there is no details whether they've reached a settlement, whether he's been punished, what that punishment is going to look like, or what's even going forward in this case. Throwing a man down on the street to arrest him when he's done nothing wrong, with a history of testifying, saying that he injured his hand when he was bitten, and we find out from the medical evidence and from the officer himself that, oh, I actually wasn't bitten, I punched the guy in the face. Or the really horrendous conduct that was caught on tape. Or the overuse of force. At what point do officers get held accountable? Because if it was you or I or a member of the general public, we would be held accountable for our actions. We would be held accountable for these things. And the institutions, if they want to be taken seriously, the institutions, if they want to be taken and have people believe that they're going to be a social good, need to be involved in making sure that there is accountability and structures of accountability. And we're not seeing that case happen at all. And again, like we talked about at the top of the show, how many more cases like this happen, but we don't know about it? We don't see the major information getting a lot of public outcry. We don't see a lot of the major information getting public because the people involved don't have the resources. They don't have the money. They don't have the capabilities like James Blake does to fight this case to such an extent that they don't have the ability to fight this case as vigorously as James Blake has. Switching gears over to hockey, the New York Rangers are set to host the 2018 Winter Classic against the Buffalo Sabres in Queens. Yes, Queens, New York, yet the Buffalo Sabres will be the home team. And if you're not that familiar with New York geography, Buffalo is 385 miles away, yet Buffalo will be the home team. To keep the Rangers' tax break in place, that when they set up the stadium in the 1980s for the New York Rangers and the New York Knicks, there's a $40 million tax break that they were given to prevent them from leaving town, and it demands that they play their home games on their home property. The rule was not ever meant to be infinite, as it now has been, and then Mayor Ed Koch said that he thought he was only signing a 10-year tax break. This has cost the city over $400 million in revenue since the tax break was put into place ad infinitum. And to keep their tax break, they're going to engage in a set of paperwork gymnastics to make the Buffalo Sabres the home team, despite being 385 miles away, so the New York Rangers can keep their $40 million a year tax break. Meanwhile, the state of Texas is trying to pass a new bill to prevent any athlete from taking testosterone treatment from being able to compete with their birth gender. Obviously, this is the reactionary pushback to high school wrestler Mack Beggs, and it's completely obvious that this is a pushback against high school wrestler Mack Beggs. Perhaps, maybe instead of this dumb idea, Texas, how about you have Mack compete as a boy, since that's his gender? Oh, but wait, you have a law in the books requiring that athletes compete as their birth sex, but you're not going to let them be trans and compete there as well. This is just another new rule that's trying to exclude trans athletes from being able to compete. It's trying to keep trans people from being to be able to be out in the public sphere. And we've seen that happening a number of times in Texas and other states. Meanwhile, the FIFA Congress passed a motion to delay the rulings on the Palestinian claims to punish the Israeli Football Association for allowing the illegal settlement teams. With this move to just delay things, it's likely that it won't be brought up until 2018. And we do hope to get Red Card Israeli Racism and their spokesperson to come back on the show with us for a future episode to talk about this in a little bit more in depth and get into a little bit more with them about it. And we really hope we can get them back on the show to discuss those issues with us. in Qatar, the Khalifa Stadium set for the 2022 World Cup is now done. And their slick PR firm and their slick PR company has put out a whole host of really fancy photos of look how great this stadium looks. Look how great this stadium, you know, appears to be with all the amazing things. And this is the same stadium where Amnesty International noticed systematic labor abuses happening in the labor conditions there. And Deadspin absolutely nailed it. They wrote an article called, quote, "This slave-built Qatari World Cup stadium sure is pretty." And they took a bunch of the promo photos from the really slick PR scheme and paired them with comments like, quote, "The likes of Neymar and Christian Pulisic are going to look great sprinting up and down that perfectly manicured pitch. So much so that you may even forget about all the years of punishing slave labor that went into its construction. Because who wants to think about heat-induced heart attacks and deplorable housing conditions when there's so many cool pictures to look at? They're just so damn neat!" Close quote. And it's a brilliant takedown of this kind of PR move, this Potemkin village, the, hey, everybody pay attention to how fancy this all looks, and not really look at all the horrific, horrendous human rights abuses that are very much right beneath the surface. But like we said, we are going to finish this with some happy news this week. The National Women's Soccer League players that do not have any national team connections have started the first steps to form their own players association. This is the first steps to them becoming a union to represent their interests. So solidarity to those workers in the National Women's Soccer League who are working towards getting their own players association and recognition of their interests, because they do not have any national team connections and they're very much interested in doing what's best for them and pushing their agenda forward as well as workers. This has been Not Another Sports Show, a Red Hook the World Sports, Left Sports Media, a weekly news hour highlighting the various intersections overlapping the world of sports, activism, and radical politics. We are available for broadcast by Pacific Radio member network stations, college and community radio stations, and low power FM stations, as a number already are taking us. If you can't listen live or you happen to miss any of today's broadcast, we are available via audio podcast on iTunes, through Stitcher Radio, and at the Google Play Store. Audio streams of our podcast and video editions are also available at notanothersportsshow.podbean.com. And coming this summer, we are setting up our brand new revamped website, so more coming there very, very soon. To contact the show, you can use at NAS Radio Sports on Twitter, at NAS Radio Sports on Instagram, Not Another Sports Show on Facebook, and the hashtag NAS Radio to reach us with your thoughts, your comments about the week's show, what you'd like to see, potential interview topics, and more. So let us know what you want to hear, your reactions to the show at NAS Radio Sports or the hashtag NAS Radio on social media. For all of us here at the broadcast, you've been listening to Not Another Sports Show, a Radical of the World of Sports, Left Sports Media, and we will be back with you next week to talk about the world of sports, activism, and politics.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words about Donald J. Trump's presidency, which is keeping staffers and streaming news alert editors busier than a flock of seagulls at low tide. Watch the network television anchors and you can see they're exhausted. That breaking news graphic broke. The new guy is making more missteps than the last place finisher in a drunken hopscotch tournament on cobblestones with a watch cap pulled over his eyes. Every day there's something. Right after firing his FBI director, the Washington Post reported the president shared classified intelligence with two Russian diplomats. But the White House said, relax. trying to convince the country that Mr. Trump was never in possession of any intelligence he could have shared. And increasingly, America is willing to believe it. The whole not in possession of any intelligence part. In defense of his disclosure of the classified Israeli intel concerning ISIS, Trump claims he can say anything to anybody because as president, he has special powers. Apparently, he was bitten by a radioactive spider. But the biggest and best and beautifulest radioactive spider ever. Now, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein appointed a special prosecutor to get to the bottom of possible Russian collusion and obstruction of justice, the fastest any president in history has ever been targeted with a special prosecutor. He must be so proud. He's gone from zero to Nixon in less than 4 months. Next up, the president is scheduled to embark on a 9-day, 5-city foreign tour visiting Saudi Arabia, Israel, Belgium, and the Vatican, ending up at the G7 conference in Italy. For a guy who hates to travel and goes off script like church bells in Ireland, what could go wrong? The G7 used to be known as the G8 until Russia was kicked out for annexing Crimea. But now that they've annexed us, looks like they're back in the loop. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
Here it is!